This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you by Nico's USA Pickups. The quintessential pickup is finally here to capture the essence of the best vintage and modern tones on the planet. We all know there are certain periods that have captivated guitar players because of their cherished tones. Nico's USA Pickups are handmade and designed to deliver just what you're looking for. Made in America, incorporating period-specific materials for the most discerning guitarist, the tone will easily captivate your ears with an amazing balance of highs, mids, and bass response, yielding unprecedented sound and feel. Authentic tones from authentic materials, handcrafted in the USA, Nico's USA Pickups. Go to nicosusapickups.com for more information.
You know, part of the reason I wanted to learn how to play guitar in the first place was to be cool. And I really wanted to be cool. But I can only hope, wish, and aspire to be as cool as our guest today. Folks, welcome to Guitar Radio Show, episode 75. And Mr. Johnny A is our guest today. Folks, well, I'm very happy and honored to be talking to Mr. Johnny A. We're going to be talking about his latest release, which is called Driven. Folks, you can go to johnnya.com and check out information there, as well as
to pick up a copy of Driven, you can go to iTunes, Amazon, CD Baby as well.
No, it's Nimbit, iTunes, Amazon, or right through the website.
And right through the website.
Yeah.
Right, cool. So how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good.
Thanks for having me here.
Hey, thanks for taking some time out. I know you're super busy, and we're here at the Dallas Guitar Show, getting ready to see you play.
Yeah, I'm psyched to be here. I've been absent because of my schedule, for about 3 years, but I was doing it every year for a while, and it's good to be back, see a lot of friends.
Well, you're one of those hardworking cats. You're always at it.
Well, got to pay the bills.
You got to do it. So, I'm always fascinated by the origins of a guitar player, particularly because I think it speaks to how they play, and how it influences their tone. What was it for you? What was the impetus for you? Because I remember once reading an article about you that as a young child you were. There was a problem, a health issue, and then you started a woodshed like crazy because you were home all the time, and you were playing, and it turned you into the player that you are now.
Well, I started as a drummer really young, like 6 years old, and I was into people like Sandy Nelson and Gene Krupa and big band Buddy Rich stuff, and then the Safaris and. And then as soon as the British invasion came along, it kind of like changed my whole outlook about what I wanted to do musically, because there was so much melody in that music that I got drawn to it, like a magnet. It was just drew me right to it. And so drums not being a melodic instrument, it just I got drawn to the instrument of the day, which was guitar.
Right.
Everybody had a guitar, so I started to teach myself how to play. Had a really cheap Lafayette Electronics $49 guitar
and a cheap
little
guitar.
$25 amp or whatever it was, and I didn't even know how to tune it. I had a couple friends. Someone showed me how to tune the guitar, and then I just taught myself everything. Never took any lessons. But, I was always, like I said, drawn to more songs and melody than necessarily guitar players. I like to think of the type of stuff that I play instrumentally is more kind of vocal oriented, or they could be songs if they had lyrics. I was always in bands that had vocals. I always wrote songs that had lyrics, always led bands and fronted the band singing. And it was only until I left Peter Wolf's band, and where I got a bronchial infection in the band and I lost my vocals, that I was forced to do something instrumentally because I couldn't sing anymore, and I didn't really want to hire a lead singer because whoever delivers the melody is the sound of your band. And then all of a sudden, you invest all this time and you invest all this money into recordings and time into developing. And if the guy that delivers the melody splits, you're really left with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided to try to do something instrumentally. I redefined my approach to guitar. I was never a chord melody guy before that. And, I was basically always a guy that just needed someone to sing, and then I'd play rhythm, and then I'd step out and do my little 20-second solo or something like that. And but this is where I wanted to be able to develop and deliver the whole song myself. But as far as who I listened to, because that was the original question, it was British Invasion, guys. It was the Beatles, it was the Stones, it was the Hollies, it was Party Rock and the Raiders, it was the Animals, the Kinks. Just kind of, I always liked melody. Then I started to get more into the British blues rock guys, and I discovered the Yardbirds and became a huge fan, still a big fan of the band. And, the guitar players that played for the Yardbirds, Beck and Clapton and Jimmy Page. And, started to get into all those kind of bands, those British blues rock bands. And I always had a voracious appetite to listen and explore different kind of musicalities. Then I started to get into a lot of the art rock progressive bands and guys like Steve Howe and Yes and Gentle Giant and I guess Emerson, Lake, and Palmer were in that whole thing. Jethro Tull, you know, Martin Barr, and then started getting into fusion, you know, and was heavy into John McLaughlin for a long time, and Bill Connors, who played in the original Return to Forever with Chick Corea.
Yeah.
Listened to a lot of that stuff, and then always was into Chet. Always went to, mm-hmm. was into Les Paul. Mm-hmm. Started to get into the heavy jazz guys. Started listening to a lot of Wes, a lot of Pat Martino, a lot of Kenny Burrell.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, my rock guys, go-to guys were always Jimi Hendrix and, you know, Jeff Beck, who I think is amazing.
It's Joe, without a doubt. It's my favorite as well. I mean, so it's interesting too, because in my notes I have, when I hear you, I hear a Pat Martino meets Jeff Beck.
Well, both those guys are monsters. You know, Jeff Beck, you know, I just think he's probably the greatest rock guitar player that ever came along. I mean, you know, truth be told, that Jimi Hendrix kind of revolutionized the thing, what happened, you know, in 1966 when he came out with his sound and kind of revolutionized the way everybody approached the guitar. But, you know, Jeff Beck, you know, you look at him since 65 and, you know, when his bands and, you know, how he came up through the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s and the 2010s. And, you know, he completely redefines himself. And yet it always still sounds like Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
You know, I can listen to, you know, New York City Blues by the Yardbirds, and I can listen to, you know, something off his new record, you know, Lead Boots, you know, Roy's Toy or something like that, and mm-hmm. it still always sounds like Jeff Beck. And the great ones have the ability to do that. They have the ability to develop, explore, expand, but maintain a singular voice, even though it continually changes. And, you know, a good case in point is the Beatles, where you can listen to Please Please Me, mm-hmm. and you can listen to Strawberry Fields Forever. And you can tell it's the same band, even though it's, you know, universes apart.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So you were born in a place called Malden, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So what was the music scene like there?
Well, you know, in school in those days, you know, I grew up in the 50s. You know, I was born in 52. So, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, there was just everybody had a band. You know, all the kids. This was the battle of the bands, the CYO centers and school bands. And so it was always a healthy, competitive music scene in the neighborhood. But as far as, like, a scene, you know, we were too young to really hang in clubs in Boston at that time. And
right.
Malden was only 5 miles from Boston, so I basically grew up in Boston proper. But we were always still taking the nickel tours and getting on the subways and the buses and going into the music stores every Saturday,
right.
and hanging out and meeting people. So, I mean, that's what the scene was like. And in the 70s, right out of high school, I just started playing in a lot of the Boston clubs, you know, and hanging around in Boston and going, you know, when I was in high school, I started to go to the concert clubs in Boston, like the Psychedelic Supermarket and the Boston Tea Party, the Arc, and got to see a lot of shows. I was really lucky in having a mom that is super, still is super supportive of my musical kind of desires and was then. I mean, she got me tickets to see the Beatles in 66. I saw Hendrix in 68.
Wow.
You know, I saw everybody. I had Steppenwolf, Crazy World of Arthur Brown, Moby Grape,
wow.
10 years after, Santana, The Who, I mean, Dave Clark 5, I mean, The Animal. I saw everybody.
I mean, the real groundswell of guitar playing coming out of that whole thing, I could see how that would be a huge influence.
Yeah, and I got to experience it when it was happening. So there's, yeah. you know, there's one thing, you know, it's kind of like you feel bad for kids that are trying to immerse themselves in music now and not really being able to experience it in real time. It's, you know, you can see movies and you can watch YouTube and you can find just about anything you want to find, but there's nothing like going to the record store and buying the Jimi Hendrix Experience album, seeing that picture in the yellow and the purple and the hands like this on it, and just not knowing anything about this guy and reading the liner notes, not knowing what kind of guitar he plays, nothing about the gear, knowing nothing. There's no MTV. There isn't anything. You know, you hear Purple Haze on the radio, and you buy the album, and you hear How You Experience, and you know, your jaw drops to the floor, and you got the black lights on in your bedroom with the glowing posters, you know, and then you finally get to see this guy, and it's like, it's bigger than life. And I saw him in a small venue. I saw him in a place in Framingham, Massachusetts, called the Carousel Theater, which, I don't know, if it held 1,100 people, I don't even know. It was very small. So seeing something like that, and those Marshall stacks, and the coiled cords, and the fuzz faces, and it was in between albums, you know, you had your imagination to wonder about the artist. That's all gone.
Yeah.
It's all gone. You know,
yeah, because it's too easy to just go to somebody's wiki page at this point.
Yeah, it kind of hurt. You know, in one way, it's kind of, you know, for an independent artist like myself, it's great that you have the technology that allows you to get yourself out there.
Right.
But in another way, it just takes a lot of the romance out of it.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword.
You know?
It really is, for sure. So coming up, you played in all these other bands, and then you ended up doing a lot of session work for people too.
Well, you know, I wouldn't say a lot of session work, but you know, I always was really more focused on being my own artist and having my own bands and writing my own songs. And you know, I did do some session stuff, and I did do some sideman stuff. And I switched over to sideman stuff when I just was not getting a record deal. You know, I came very, very close in early 70s and mid 70s. I played with a lot of acts, with Rick Derringer and Aerosmith and David Johansen, and came very close to getting record deals, but never did. And that's when he decided to become a sideman, and you know, worked a little bit with this cat by the name of Mingo Lewis, who was a percussionist with Santana and John McLaughlin and Demiola. And then I worked with Doug Clifford for a little while from Creedence Clearwater, which was the first time I met Bobby Whitlock. And then later on, I was Bobby Whitlock's musical director about 15 years after I had met him. And then, you know, with Peter Wolf. And now playing on Friends records, you know, little things here and there. But I was always more interested in being my own artist.
Yeah.
You know.
Let's talk about Driven. Let's talk about this new disc. This came out in
about, well, maybe just under a year.
Yeah. The opening track is a bit of a departure for you in some respects.
Well, if you know me, it's not. But it's, as far as if you only know me from my recorded work, it is.
Yeah.
The album's a departure from my previous recorded work, but it's not really a stretch from what I am as a player at all. You know. But I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. I mean, tell us more about the record and what it means to you. What were you shooting for, and did you get it?
Well, I was definitely shooting for an album that was much more backbeat. I wanted to get away from shuffles and swings. Mm-hmm. I wanted to develop myself more vocally on the guitar, and I wanted an album that was more produced. I wanted it to have a little bit more of a rock edge to it, and I wanted it to be different. A different departure from what I had shown in the past, and you know, and that's a double-edged sword too, because you get people that are in love with Sometime Tuesday Morning, and it, you know, they want you to make another Sometime Tuesday Morning until you make another Sometime Tuesday Morning, and then they say he's doing the same thing all over again.
That's true.
But then you put out something like Driven that's different. They said, "Well, I wish he'd do what he used to do." So it's like, you know, I think as an artist, you just can't really chase. You know, chase that dragon. You just have,
right,
have to do what you do. And I was compelled to do it this way. Originally, I had let go of my whole band, and I looked for different players. And I played with a couple different drummers, a couple different bass players, a couple different guitar players. And I definitely had in my mind how I wanted this record to come out. And right from before I even recorded the first note, most of the songs were written in the studio. There's only really two exceptions on the album. One was Arizona Man, which was the song's about 20 years old. I wrote it a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is the Bee Gees cover, To Love Somebody.
Right.
But all the other songs were written specifically for this record while I was recording. And when I was doing these pre-production kind of auditions or rehearsals, whatever you want to call them, with other players, I was not getting back. What I was hearing through their speakers and their playing was not what I was hearing in my head. And I was just determined. I had just built a studio, a full-blown studio, and I was determined to make the record sound the way I wanted it to sound, because you never know if you're going to get a chance to make another one or not.
Sure.
So at the end of the day, you have to, at least for me, is I have to really be 100% committed to what I put out, or else I don't want to put it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where all you got left is your word, your name, and what you leave behind.
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided to make the whole record myself. And I engineered it. I wrote everything except for the cover. Played every instrument on it. Did all the editing. Did all the mixing. The only thing I didn't do was master it. Bob Ludwig mastered it.
I'll say, though, you know, even though it's a departure, there's that difference.
Mm-hmm.
There's still that sameness, because you're one of those guitar players, because of your tone, and I want to talk about tone with you. Because of your tone, usually you're one of those cats that when I hear one note, I go, oh, that's him.
Well, that's a great compliment. Thank you.
And that's something I want to understand, because as a guitar player since 1975, I'm still chasing tone.
Well, I do every day.
You do?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank God, because I got to tell you, that's a relief.
And I guarantee you, I bet you everybody does. I bet you Jeff Beck still does, you know. I bet you he still works on stuff. I think that comes from, you know, I don't think it's, the tone is not, you know, these guys that have a tone or a voice or, you know, whatever term you want to put on that. That really doesn't come from the amplifier they use. It really doesn't come from the guitar they use. It really comes from how they think of it and how they're feeling it. I mean, case in point, I went to see Robin Ford the other night, and I went to talk to him. We hung out for a little while at Soundcheck, and he had his Dumble with him. He said, "You ever play through a Dumble?" And I actually played through his rig a long time ago. He says, "Hey, check it out." And he says, "They're really articulate amplifiers." You know, and I played the amp. It doesn't sound like Robin Ford playing through a Dumble. It sounds like Johnny Avery. It sounds the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I have all different size rigs.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what rigs I play through, it still sounds the mm-hmm. same. You know, some better than other, obviously, because gear might come into play. But it's the way that, you express, mm-hmm. you strike the string. It's, a lot of it, I think, for me, has got to do with my right hand. I have a lot of right hand dynamics, and I work on that a lot. But I just think it's the way the guy feels it. And the voice comes from being an extension of the person,
mm-hmm.
you know. You can tell a lot of what someone's personality is like by the type of player they are. You know,
yeah.
Like you know, you listen to Jeff Beck, and I've always thought he was a very sarcastic player. He sounded very sarcastic, and you know, I got the opportunity to. Well, I met him several times now, and I opened up for him in 2001, and then I met him a couple times after that, and then I had the opportunity to do a rock and roll fantasy camp where he was the marquee guy, so I got to sit on stage with him, play with him, and they did a Q&A with him. And he's a really funny guy, and uh-huh. he's a really sarcastic guy.
Uh-huh.
And all those years of listening to the Yardbirds and those quirky little licks and
uh-huh.
the fade-outs and the how he released and all that kind of tongue-in-cheek playing, that's really just like he is as a person, at least in my vision of him,
right.
or my view of him, not vision, but view.
Right. So then how would you describe yours?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. It's hard. I can be a wise ass. But, you know, I have a very introspective side of my personality as well. And,
yeah.
You know, and I'm as much as Ghost as I am Wichita Lineman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think a lot of the players that I like are diverse like that. You know,
yeah.
Jeff Beck's like that. I mean,
yeah.
You hear Jeff Beck, and he can play
yeah.
some of that stuff off Guitar Shop, and then he plays, you know, A Day in the Life on Nadia.
Yeah. Danny Boy.
Oh, Danny Boy, yeah. And I think most of the great guys, you know, have deep pockets. you know.
For sure. And we're talking about that whole idea with tone, what you were saying about the guy. It's who they are and how they're approaching it. Billy Gibbons said it was meat touching metal, touching wood.
Mm.
You know, basically, it's our DNA
mm-hmm.
being electrified,
mm-hmm.
which is fascinating to me. And hearing you say that, you're still searching for tone.
Well, yeah, it's
really a relief for me.
Well, it's probably because you probably never stop trying to discover who you are as a person. So, mm-hmm. I mean, is you know, part of me as a person. I mean, the longest relationships I have in my life are my mother, my father, and my guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the three longest relationships. You know, my mother, my father, since I was obviously born, they're both alive still. And I started playing guitar when I was 11. I don't have a longer relationship other than my parents with anything.
Right.
And I mean, 11, that's 51 years.
Yeah.
I don't have a long... I mean, my wife is, you know, 33 years.
That's a very good point. When I think about what you're saying, yeah, same goes for me.
And my relationship with my guitar is it was never like a sideline thing. From the second I picked it up, it was 8 hours a day. So it's constantly has been part of me.
Well, see, and that's obvious in your playing. It's obvious that you've spent so much time with this instrument. And it's... And I said this to Sonny last night, Sonny Landreth, when I was talking to him last night. It's an extension of who you are.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have a personality out without a guitar, you know, to be honest with you, because it's like, I don't even, you know, it's just there. It's like the shirt. Or it's like the, you know, it's just there. You know,
it's like skin.
Just kind of part of it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about guitars.
Okay.
Not a whole lot of folks, quite a few folks have their own Gibson model. What was that like for you?
Well, that's still
is that a trip?
Pinch me.
Yeah.
It's a still pinch me moment occasionally.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's been now the guitar has been on the market since 2003, so it's 13 years, mm-hmm. going into 13 years.
And it's a beautiful instrument.
Yeah, it came up, the way it came about was my relationship with Gibson has gone back since 94 when I was with Wolf. And I just cold called Gibson one day, called a custom shop. And ended up talking to this guy, I think it was Tim Boland, was with Gibson at the time. And I told him who I was, and, you know, I just told him who I was working with, and are you looking for any endorsees, artists? And he said, yeah, we're always looking for people, and blah, 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 and people that really would be good ambassadors for the brand, and, you know, promote the brand in a positive way with their playing and with the way they are as people. And he said, but I'm leaving, and we have a new guy coming in, Mike McGuire. And why don't you give a call next week? I'll write a little note that you called in. And I called the next week, and I spoke with Mike, and we immediately hit it off. He's just a great guy. I love him to death. He's since left Gibson about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He retired. He actually was the guy that started Valley Arts Guitars.
Oh, okay.
So he said, sure. And so I immediately had a relationship with the custom shop. I didn't really go through any red tape or any, you know, it was just me and the custom shop. And he built me my first Les Paul Burst. It was beautiful. And I was still playing with Wolf. This was 1993-94. And I stopped playing with Wolf in 99, but I was with Gibson all that time. And through those years, they were building me, you know, 335s, Les Pauls, different guitars. And when I left Wolf and started my solo record, my first solo record, sometime Tuesday morning, I was looking for a specific tone on a guitar. And I knew I wanted to use Bigsby because I wanted just that vocal vibrato sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried a bunch of different guitars, and I decided I did not want to use Gretsch's because of Brian Setzer. And I just ended up walking into a music store and seeing an ES-295, you know, the Scotty Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked it up and I played it, and immediately the guitar spoke to me. I said, oh, this will do it. So I bought that guitar from a music store in Boston, put flat wound strings on it, started to work on this whole sound thing, and That's the that's the guitar that's on the cover of that album, and that's on about 70-75% of that album. And things started going really well. I got picked up by Steve Vai's label. I got a really good booking agency. The first single went to number one across the country, sold 100,000 albums. And then I started talking to Gibson, and I know what it was. I started to use the 295 live. It was a beast to use live. It would feedback, because I don't play soft. I play fairly loud. Mm-hmm. So I started to use a 295, my 335, and a Les Paul, all with Bigsby's, for the show. And I really didn't like that. I don't like switching guitars. I like to just use one guitar. I don't like the ergonomics. They change. The switches are in different places. This neck is, right, you know, joins at the 19th fret. This one joins at the 16th fret. This one joins at the 18th fret. This guitar is 3.5 inches wide and 16 inches. This one's 13 inches and an inch. It's just too much minutia for me. Mm-hmm. I just want to feel comfortable with what I play all night. I'll switch them for different tunings or something, but I just want to know something's home base. So, you know, I started to use all Les Pauls. They started to make me 59 Storix with Bigsby's, which they weren't making for anybody. They were just stop tight tails, and I started using Bigsby's. I bought three of them they made me. One with flat wounds, one with round wounds, and one was just a backup. So I needed three guitars for the show. And I went down to Summonam, and I was talking with Rick Gembar, who still is the GM down at Custom Shop. And he says, "How are the Les Pauls working out for you?" And, you know, you can't put the guitar down. It's a great guitar. You know, I said, "You know, Rick, they're really, really great guitars." I said, "But I'm really missing the hollow tone that I used to get. I wish there was a way to come up with something that kind of gave me the agility of a Les Paul, but the warmth and the kind of vocal hollow tone of my 295. And they asked me if I had any ideas, and I said, "Yeah, I got some ideas." So it started. That started in 2002. And then in 2003, exactly a year later, the guitar came out.
Wow.
That's how it started.
So during that process, was there a lot of versions that came your way for you to try?
No.
So they nailed it on the first go around?
Well, there was an original prototype that was around that I ended up buying from them at the show. And I said, "This is the guitar." And this was not a guitar that was ever planning to come out. But it needed changes. It needed some changes. And I was down there probably every 2 weeks for the better part of a year.
Uh-huh.
Working with Matthew Klein, who's the guy that does all the computer CAD stuff, and working on the dish and working on the neck profile and, you know, working on the materials and the aesthetics and all that stuff. And they sent me the two prototypes, 0001 and 0002, in March of 2003 when I was making the Get Inside album.
Mm-hmm.
And they were perfect. The guy said, "Yeah, just make them like this. That's great." And
well, that's fantastic that they hit it.
You know, and to Gibson's credit, I mean, I'm not a big star. It was less, you know, even less people knew who I was then. And still a lot of people don't know who I am. And to have that much faith and put in an artist model, mm-hmm. that was pretty incredible. It definitely was a pinch me moment, you know, driving down and
sure.
listening to, and I remember calling my wife when I got home one day, and I'm driving down the road in my van, and Chet Atkins comes on, and, you know, Gibson, Chet Atkins. I had to pinch myself and call my wife and said, "I can't believe my name's going to be at the end of a Gibson guitar." Because, you know, you never aspire for anything like that.
No. Some people dream about it, but...
I never dreamt about it. I just never, you know, I didn't really think that was something that was a plausible thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, anything's possible, but
yeah.
I never thought it was plausible.
Right.
You know?
I think it's to their credit that they did it, too. I mean, they recognized what you were bringing to the table as far as quality of playing. So, I mean, hearing you play, it kind of makes sense to me.
Well, you know, the cool thing about Gibson... is in the old days, you know, obviously all of their signature artists were guys that used the guitar as a voice.
Yeah.
Whether it was Wes, whether it was Tal Farlow, whether it was Barney Kessel, whether it was, you know, Hank Garland, whether it was Chet, Les. And of recent times, a lot of the guitar manufacturers, the signature guys, they're guitar players in bands that have a singer. You know, and they're the guitar player in the band and that they're identified for. But, you know, it was interesting that when they took me on, I was a guy that was really using their guitar as the voice. It wasn't behind us lead vocalist. It was, you know, the guitar is the voice again.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, Hank Garland's a great example of that, for sure. So with the record, are you out now? You're out on the road?
I'm constantly in touring mode. I want to work as much as I can.
You're a road dog.
Well, I have to be. I got bills to pay. So.
All right, cool. And folks, you can go to johnnya.com to find out more about where you're touring, where you're playing, and everything else. We're going to get a treat tonight.
Well, we do the jams tonight and tomorrow night, and then my band is flying in on Saturday, and we do a show on Sunday.
Yeah, that's going to be good.
It's going to be good. It's great to be back here.
I'm looking
Dallas.
Forward to it. Yeah, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Well, Johnny, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to spend some time with us and share.
No, thank you, Mark.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Folks, go to johnnya.com. Check out the record Driven. It will do you good. iTunes, Amazon. Where else did you say?
johnnya.com and Nimbit.
Nimbit. Okay, cool. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank
All
you
right.
guys.
The track is called The Arizona Man, and it is from the album Driven by Johnny A. Folks, go check it out. Fantastic. Thank you, Johnny, for being on the show. Your sets at Dallas Guitar Show were just amazing. The jams were incredible. He is just classy, smooth, and cool as hell. I dig him. So check him out. Driven is the name of the album. Hey, I also want to mention and say hey and thank you to our newest sponsor, Nico's USA Pickups. Go to nicosusapickups.com and check out stuff there. Really good. We got some stuff coming. We got a giveaway coming from Nico's. We're going to be giving away a set of pickups. So go to guitarradioshow.com and go to the Contact GRS tab. Put your information in there. Say, hey, I want those pickups. And in the comment section, and you will be automatically entered into the drawing for that. And I will let you know when that drawing will be. We will also be getting a set in one of the Strats around here and be giving you some demos coming up real soon. And I think there's going to be an interview with those guys as well. So we're looking forward to that. But hey, we got to get out of here. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you, everybody who is listening all over the planet. Man, I can't believe it, how cool this is and how cool you all are for subscribing and tuning in and listening all over the planet. Meantime, keep on playing. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. And we'll see you on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace.
I like this crowd already.
GRS Productions.